Thanks, Liz. How do I sound up there? Everybody hear me okay? Either you all can or you all can't, because nobody said anything. Thank you for coming, everybody. Talking today about kernel development processes. I don't talk about technical things anymore because I don't get to do any more programming and I've forgotten how to do it. So basically, split the talk today into two halves. I'll spend quite a lot of time reviewing what the current kernel development process is, how we got there, why we got there. I'll spend the second half of our time today discussing the process by which new features get merged into the kernel. We'll look at who the interested parties are in the feature development and integration process. We'll discuss the right and wrong ways in which people should prepare and submit features. And spend quite a bit of time doing a walkthrough of what the feature submission process is or should be. And then spend a bit of the time at the end discussing kernel bug resolution processes. This is my attempt to depict the release history of the Linux kernel, the kernel.org Linux kernel, over the past 9 years or so. It's a pretty standard looking release model for a long-lived software product. You'll find that Microsoft Windows, Solaris, Microsoft Vista, you name it, they all follow the same sort of model. We have, that's the trunk, that's the kernel.org kernel, which Linus Torvalds has always maintained. And every few years, we will take a branch off the trunk for stabilization purposes, something which we'll ship out to our customers. So we have the 2.0 trunk, the 2.4 trunk, or the 2.4 branch, the 2.2 branch, and the 2.4 branch. The numbering system we use in the Linux kernel, many of you are familiar, is the second digit, 2.2, indicates that it's a stable release. If that's an odd number, it means it's an unstable release. It's a development kernel, could crash and chew your hard disk at any time. So, starting off from, say, the end of the 2.1 series, at the start of 1999, Linus declared 2.2.0. Then Linus continued to control 2.2 development until we hit 2.2.8. At that point there, we branched off the kernel. So the 2.2 series was branched off and handed over to Alan Cox to stabilize. And Linus then immediately declared 2.3.0, which was a new development kernel, and people started putting new code into that development kernel for the next couple of years till Linus declared 2.4, and then Linus continued to control the kernel through 2.4.1 right up to 2.4.15. Then at this point, we branched off another stable release, the 2.4 series, which was handed over to Marcelo to maintain. And on that very same day, Linus converted 2.4.15 into 2.5.0, which is another development stream, and we proceeded with 2.5 development that turned into 2.6. Also, and we'll come to this later, on that particular day where Linus branched 2.5.0 and 2.4.15, both of those trees started being managed under a revision control system, namely BitKeeper. Something you'll notice is missing here, 2.6.10, we should have branched off, and the tree should have been handed over to Andrew Morton while Linus Torvalds went off for the 2.7 tree. We did not do that, and we shall not do that, and I very much doubt we will ever do that. We changed the development process completely, and I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about that. The new development process, the one we adopted formally a couple of years ago, came about for a number of reasons. Those odd-numbered trees, the 2.1 tree here and the 2.3 tree, they are in development for several years, average maybe 2 years. That's a long time for a tree to be unstable. And what would happen was, if a developer had a new feature, a particularly important feature, we didn't want to merge that into the stable tree because that would destabilize a stable tree, so it's expected the developer would put his feature into the unstable tree. Now, it turned out that in the 2.5 series, the quality of the releases was considerably better than it had been in the 2.3 series and in the 2.1 series. The 2.5 kernel was always basically usable. It's got a bit wobbly around 2.5.9, 2.5.10, but as long as you're using popular device drivers, you could use the 2.5 kernel pretty much all the time. Management of the quality of the kernel had improved. And one of the main reasons for doing this was simply the code base had improved. The need to do massive rewrites of underlying systems has largely gone away. We're pretty happy with how a lot of the kernel infrastructure is working nowadays. So as we proceeded through the 2.5 series, we found we were doing a major release about once a month. And after a year or so, that had stretched out to about 2 months. Now, the kernel summit in Ottawa in 2004, we sat down and they ask every time, when are you going to branch 2.7? And I never wanted to branch 2.7, I just did not want to do it, and I kind of thumped the desk fairly hard, and we did make the decision that we were not going to branch a 2.7. We were going to continue to develop 2.6 the way we had been developing 2.5 and 2.6, and that's just a continual rolling release. There are numbers of reasons for doing that. If we look back the 2.3 series, for example, some developer writes an important feature. It wouldn't be accepted into 2.4 because that's the stable kernel, and you're not supposed to do that sort of thing to the stable kernel. So instead, the developer was supposed to put his code into the 2.5 tree, or into the 2.3 tree, or the 2.1 tree. This means that his new feature would not be available to the general public via a distributor for multiple years. That's simply not acceptable. Nobody wants to write code and not have it available to the public for several years. Now, the distributors, they didn't have that option. They had to ship new code. I mean, if it's a new device driver, the hardware manufacturer doesn't want to wait 3 years before Linux supports his new device. So the distributors are put in the position where they had to go on these great big fishing expeditions through the 2.5 kernel, pull out features they wanted, and backport them into their own 2.4 tree. And nobody liked them doing that. The distros ended up carrying 1,000, 2,000 patches, some of them very significant. It was duplicated effort because we had a patch that was in the 2.5 tree, it was also in the SUSE tree, it was in the Red Hat tree, and whoever knows what trees. Lots of different people independently maintaining the same feature. There's a risk that the features could become divergent over time, so Linux would end up offering different interfaces or different behavior on different versions of, or different distributions, which would be... Nobody wants that to happen. And there's a risk that incompatibilities between the various backports could sneak in over time. So basically, in the early days, we weren't serving our main customer properly. I mean, for we on the public kernel, our main immediate customers are the distributors. They're the people from whom most people obtain their Linuxes. And the work we were doing on the kernel.org kernel was not well suited to the requirements of our main customers. So nowadays, our release cycle is stretched out to about 3 months. We do a 2.6.x about every 3 months. The process we follow is, after Linux has released 2.6.x, say 2.6.15, we'll have a window of about 2 to 3 weeks where everybody is supposed to get all their stuff for the next release merged into Linux's tree. So developers who've been working on new features for the past 2 to 3 months, say they were working on that feature while 2.6.15 was in stabilization, have got 2 weeks to get all their code into Linux's tree. Then after that 2 weeks is over, we will declare 2.6.17 release candidate 1, and we go into bug fix only mode. We won't take new features. So it's a pipelining model, if you like. People are working on their features for the next release of the kernel while we're stabilizing the current kernel. And then we'll eventually, at the end of the 3 months, we'll hit release candidate 5, release candidate 6. I don't think we've hit 7 yet. And then we will release the actual next version of the production kernel. This pretty picture is a depiction of the rate of change of the kernel.org kernel. It's Linux's tree. The horizontal axis, number of days, so this covers about 4 years. The vertical axis here is the number of lines either added or deleted, so it's the number of lines changed. You'll see across this period here of about 4 years, we've changed 12 million lines. So we're changing line about 9,000 lines of code a day. We didn't go to sleep here. I lost some data. Sorry. So all this stuff really should be moved up a bit, and this figure here is probably more like 10,000 lines a day, which is quite a lot. I don't think I read them all. Other thing that's notable here, this 2 to 3 week merge window I mentioned, we really became strict about that at Kernel Summit last year, so about 1 year ago. And you can see the effects of it here. After 2.6.14 came out, massive amount of patch bombing here, and then the rest of the period is stabilization, more patch bombing, stabilization. Now you can see we're about halfway through the 2.6.17 release cycle. Once 2.6.17 comes out, we'll be off the graph. We weren't as well behaved back in this period here. We were still putting significant amount of change in the kernel only a few days before the release. The reason we did this, of course, was to attempt to increase the quality, decrease the bugginess of the kernels, tell people to slow down, concentrate on bug fixes. I don't know if it's decreased our defect rate or not, but at least it gives me a pretty graph. Next thing I'd like to do is identify the various groups, individuals, and entities who have a stake in the kernel.org development process. These also tend to be the groups who have a stake in the code base itself, but who are the various parties who have an interest in the development process? The distros, again, I view these people as our main immediate customers, the people who we immediately serve. The distros, they want the latest features to be available from the kernel.org kernel, and it's in their interest that there's minimum divergence between the kernel.org kernel and their own kernels, and consequently, I believe it's in Linux's interest that there be minimum divergence between the various distro kernels. And the best way we do that is by keeping the distros as close as possible to the kernel.org kernel, in theory. Hardware companies, they have a strong interest in the development process because they want their latest platform support to be available by the distros as soon as possible. Distros, being good Linux community people, have told the hardware companies, no, we don't want your device drivers, we want you to get it upstream first, and we'll get it from kernel.org. Thank you for doing that. I think it's in everybody's interest that we proceed that way. Consequently, many, but not all, of the hardware companies have learnt how to work with people like me and all the various subsystem maintainers, and they have expanded the Linux kernel development community. So we're now seeing increasing number of contributions, enormous amount from Intel, for example, and a lot from SCSI vendors, network card vendors, etc. They're all coming on board. They're working with the public kernel to get their device support fed up into the distros, which I think is a good model. Another stakeholder is the original equipment manufacturers. These are people who make some sort of device, and they then download a kernel.org kernel and ship their device and their applications on top of it based on a kernel.org kernel. Often these are embedded or consumer electronic devices. They're much more quiet, but we do get work done on the public kernel by these people, and they are a stakeholder. Other stakeholders are those minority of people who get their Linux kernel from kernel.org rather than from a distributor. And it's in their interest that the kernel be up to date with respect to their hardware and also that it be as defect free as possible. Particularly because many of these individuals who download the kernel.org kernel, they are our main QA laboratory. They are the people who do our testing. And it's in our interest that we keep them happy. The individual kernel developers themselves, they have a strong stake in the kernel development process. They want their work to be available, to be merged promptly, to be tested and reviewed well, and to be released to the public in the shortest possible time. The final stakeholder I would identify is the kernel itself, as an entity. The kernel wants to be a high quality, feature complete, and bug-free and maintainable piece of software. And this is interesting. If some random person sent some patch, it's the ghastly looking thing, but it wasn't buggy and it did something useful, but it made a mess of the kernel, made the kernel less maintainable, but it's a good patch, it was a fun patch. All these first five stakeholders, they all want the patch. They don't care if it mucks up the kernel. They don't care if it makes the kernel harder to understand or harder to maintain. all of those stakeholders want this crappy-looking patch merged. But this stakeholder doesn't. He wants a high-quality patch, one that's maintainable and understandable and can be built upon. So it's by that tension and the interests of the kernel as a living body of code against all the people who use it is another of these trade-offs where we need to find some sort of balance. And every individual developer, we train them, every individual developer understands that we care about the quality of the code base from an engineering perspective, rather than purely caring about what it does for end users. Here is my attempt to illustrate what happens to patches, how patches get from purple people all the way up to Linus's tree. So I have the green line represents a merge, where actual code is actually transferred from one person to another. And the red lines, that's purely a testing flow, where a patch will be forwarded for testing but won't necessarily stay at its destination. And there are basically there are three different ways in which an individual coder will get his code into Linus's tree. Probably most of the code will go into one of these 60, I've identified 65 separate subsystem trees. SCSI, ACPI, XFS, USB, there are all sorts of them. So an individual developer will send his submission into, let's say, it's a SCSI patch, he sends it into James. James will merge that into his tree with a view to sending it onto Linus in the next merge window. Meanwhile, about once or twice a week, I will grab James's tree and put it into my tree, but I will never send James's patch onto Linus. James does that directly. I will periodically suck on James's tree so I can redistribute all the work he has buffered up out for external testing. Now there are about 40 subsystem trees which the maintainers have chosen not to maintain their own Git tree. Usually this is because they just don't have the volume. So in fact, my tree will, for those 40 subsystems, my tree will act as the repository. Much as the SCSI tree is for SCSI patches, my tree is the repository for frame buffer patches. And a lot of these trees are empty. At any particular time, maybe a third of the Git trees are empty and probably more than half of these trees are empty. The third route by which an individual can get code in the kernel usually is by sending it directly to me. And I will review the code myself or get somebody else, hopefully, to review it. And I'll buffer it up in my tree until the next merge window, and I will send it on to Linus. It's fairly rare for a person to send a random patch to Linus and he'll pick it up. In fact, Linus is pretty random when it comes to patches at the best of times. But often people will send a patch to myself and to Linus. And Linus will see me on the CC line and he'll just ignore it because he knows I'll pick it up and send it to him once it's been reviewed and tested. So looking in a little bit more detail at the subsystem trees, in particular these ones here, which are maintained in a revision control system. Before that great branch of when we split 2.4.15 from 2.5.0, we weren't using any form of revision control system at all, and every single patch was emailed to Linus, and he reviewed them and merged them by hand, and occasionally periodically published a tarball with everybody's patches in them. After 2.4.15, we moved development into the 1980s, and we started using a revision control system, BitKeeper from the company BitMover, which brought in all those wonderful things which you get with a revision control system. Later on, probably 2 years later, in 2.6.12, we abandoned BitKeeper and we started using Git or JIT or whatever, however you like to pronounce it. But that didn't change anything from a process perspective. We stopped using one tool, used the other, but none of the processes surrounding that tool changed. Those 65 subsystem maintainers who do maintain a BitKeeper tree or a Git tree, they use it for three main purposes. One is for buffering up patches for contributors, from their contributors, ready for the next merge window. They use their tree for merging their pending work into Linux's tree during the merge window via a network transfer, a git-to-git merge. The third reason all these trees are online is so that I can pull them down and redistribute them to the community for testing. So I'll integrate these 100 trees and all the patches I'm sitting on once or twice a week and put them out for long-suffering people to test. Now, the effect of moving to BitKeeper, it changed the way Linus worked. Apparently, every single patch was manually handled by him, and he felt an obligation to review it and check it, and things got lost and he got overwhelmed. He's often said that one of the great things about BitKeeper was it forced him not to fiddle with the patches. He would either take them or not take them. So what that means is, back in the bad old days, Linus had to sit there and manually review every patch. Well, we still do it. But instead of one person doing it, now we've got 65, 105, 106 people doing it. Much delegation, so this reviewing and integration process got pushed out to a lot of other people. So in many cases, a patch will go in the tree and Linus and I just weren't aware of it. A lot more delegation happened. The MM tree originally meant memory management, because once upon a time I was normally the memory management maintainer, but then I started taking patches from everywhere. It is a repository for, I hold those 65 subsystem trees purely for testing purposes. It is the staging area for the subsystem trees where the maintainers don't use Git. Normally it has between 700 and 1,500 patches in it. It also acts as a staging area for works which are still under development. So if somebody is partway through development of a feature but he has a core of the code, I'll take that into my tree so that we can have that under test and review while he's doing additional work on top of it. And finally, when all the patches are lined up in the MM tree and we're happy, I'll send them all off to Linus in a single hit. Consequently, the MM tree at any point in time is basically what Linus's tree is going to look like in 2 or 3 months' time after the next merge window. And a lot of stupid bugs get fixed in MM. Often, I really wish people would send me code that compiles. Probably 75% of them do. And there are a lot of crashes and bugs and general rubbish gets sorted out in the MM tree. And it really is an essential part of the process, because if we didn't have MM sitting there, then all of these problems wouldn't really be discovered until the patches actually hit Linus's mainline tree. The quality of the mainline tree would be low, it would probably be no better than MM is, and that would impact everybody else's ongoing development. Anyway, so that's a quick rundown of the kernel development model, the new kernel development process. I'd now spend some time looking at the process for merging new features into Linus's kernel tree. The feature development process, computer scientists, I think they used to use these terms, attempt to break the process down into several steps: the requirements, the design, development, submission, the review process, the merging into the public tree, and the external testing. I'll walk through those. But first, I'd like to define three terms which are particularly relevant to the feature integration process. Stakeholders. And I'm not referring here to stakeholders in the kernel as a whole, but stakeholders in a particular feature. If somebody is working on a particular feature, there will be other parties out there around the world who have an interest in that feature. And to me, I don't want to understand your new feature. I would be perfectly happy not to look at it. I like to know that all the stakeholders, all the subject matter experts have looked at their patch, they're all happy with it, and I can put it in and not even have to think about it. So stakeholders, to me, are very important that they be identified and made happy. The stakeholders in a particular feature, they tend to be the distributors, the large IT companies, the hardware manufacturers, and end users, the people who are supposed to use your feature once it's merged up. And I think we don't hear very well from, I don't think we hear adequately from end users when we're initially discussing a feature. Most of the requirements analysis, implementation, the interface details is worked out generally by the developers who will be implementing the feature, as well as other stakeholders. and we don't hear much from the end users during the early stage of design. But on the other hand, many of the people who contribute to the kernel, the large IT companies and the distros, they do have long-standing and intimate relationships with end users. Hopefully they know what their users need. So even though we don't engage end users particularly well during the design process, some of the main kernel stakeholders one trusts are there to represent their users' interests during the development. Another term, merge early, which roughly maps onto Eric Raymond's bazaar. We very much prefer that when a feature is being merged into the kernel, that it comes in incrementally, in that the team who's submitting it, that they will get a basic working core of the feature ready, and they will submit that. And when that's merged, they can continue development against it, rather than trying to merge it all in one hit. One of the reasons for doing that is because it makes the reviewing of their submission much easier, because it's a smaller piece of code and it does one thing, and it implements new interfaces but doesn't try to use them at the same time. The other indirect effect of merging a working core first, it tends to put a better discipline upon the people who are doing the development. It makes them think better about the interfaces between their core and the clients who use that core. It makes them think a bit better about how their new feature will integrate with the rest of the kernel. It also means that while their core has been merged into the public kernel, it's undergoing test and review whilst they are developing more of their feature. So we are able to pipeline the public testing with their development. On the other hand, if they'd chosen to hold all the code back until it was complete, then by the time it went in, none of it would have had public testing. And this discipline of part merging the feature, it helps the mindset of the development team. It avoids the temptation for them to hold on to the feature, hold on, keep adding more and more stuff until it's absolutely perfect. And we don't get to see that feature until they've invested far too much work into it. One example where this process worked well was with the serial ATA drivers, which Jeff Garzik primed, where he just merged a little bit of the core and then more and more features and drivers are coming in. Now, that's a particularly easy example because it's a whole bunch of separate drivers which are separate from each other. But this has worked. There are other examples. For example, the NUMA page migration feature, which Christoph Lameter at SGI is working on, he's done that very well. He avoided the temptation to implement this massive feature and hit me with it all at once. He's come up with a little core which would migrate via swap space, and then he's come up and enhanced it a little bit more, so we migrate via swap cache and a little bit more. He's been avoiding that and optimizing it and refining it while the feature is currently in Linux's kernel. Third term is what I like to call the source forge syndrome, which Eric would have called the cathedral. This is where the development team go off in the little sandbox and they work madly against some source forge tree and they don't tell anybody else about it. Eventually they'll come onto the mailing list with a mammoth patch, which nobody has the time, energy or inclination to attempt to review. And inevitably what will happen is we'll look at their implementation, we'll basically ignore it. We want to first go back and look at what does the thing do? What are the interfaces? What requirements are you satisfying? What are the use cases? So we'll go back and we'll start re-examining decisions which the design team had made a year ago, a year and a half ago. And they don't like it when you do that to them. If we do request large changes, what will happen is the contributors, they will attempt to justify the design decisions they've made. And there's a lot of tension, a lot of friction. Sometimes a feature won't get merged at all because the development team just don't want to do that amount of rework and we don't want to accept the code as it stands. Very bad. People shouldn't do it. One example in that case, which is exercising my mind at present, is Perfmon, which is a performance. It's an interface that allows applications to get access to the CPU's performance monitoring counters. What Hewlett-Packard have there is a very complete, very rich feature which they've been working on for several years. They're shipping the thing out to customers. People are dependent on all its features. And we've really not spent much time looking at it at all. It's massive. We don't understand what it does. But people want this feature, and somehow we're going to have to integrate it into the kernel. It may be we're going to have to insist that certain features are not acceptable, or they're not the way we want to do it, or we want them redone. And this will have an impact on Hewlett-Packard's existing customers who are using this feature. It's not a good state of affairs. Sometimes this development in isolation is kind of unavoidable because some features, it's not easy to break them down into an initial working core and then little add-on features. I got some examples listed there. But even in the case of a file system, it's possible just to merge a core, particularly RiseFS, which has a bunch of, which has a plug-in architecture. We could have merged the core and then later merged the plugins. There is a middle ground here. If people do have a large piece of code, they don't have to develop it on SourceForge. They can set up a tree and they can send it to me, and I can include their tree in the MM kernel. I've had some trees, patches in my kernel for 2 years before they went up to Linus or they fell out. But I'd certainly welcome that. If a team is developing a feature outside the tree, they should at least try to get into my kernel so people can see that it's coming, understand what it does, look for interactions, provide them feedback, etc. So enough of my three terms. Let's look at the feature development process from the top. All good features start out with the requirement analysis. We don't have a cabal that sits down and decides what Linux is going to look like 2 years from now. People often ask me, what's going to be in the kernel in 12 months' time? I don't know. Depends what people send me. I don't make that decision. The decisions about what feature is going to go into the kernel are made by the people who own the programmers who are going to do the work. So all I can tell you is what I know people are working on out there. Some of our requirements comes from other operating systems. In some respects, we're still catching up. There are features which have been available in, for example, other Unixes for some time. People want them in Linux. So there's not much requirements analysis to be done because people have already been using that sort of feature in other operating systems for a number of years and they know what it's supposed to do. Some features going to Linux, of course, are unique to Linux, and basically the developers who are working on the feature get to define what the requirements are and what the implementation is. As far as I'm concerned, the process of identifying the stakeholders in the feature is compulsory. If I see a new feature come up, I need to know that all the other people who have an interest in that feature have been identified, and they've had a look at it, and they're reasonably happy with it. So, for example, if it's one that's causing me problems at present is statistics, enhanced statistics management of the kernel. There are a whole bunch of people doing a whole bunch of different things, and some of them are working together, some of them are working at odds. I'm not going to take anything until all these people have gone off and sorted out what they want to do. And then if I can see that all the relevant stakeholders are happy with the feature, then we can start talking about merging it up. Consequently, this coordination between the various, and often they're commercial competitors, bad luck, you'll have to work that out. The coordination between them isn't as good as it should be. And as a consequence of that, we suffer because the feature comes available, becomes visible when it's too far advanced. We have to get them to rewind and re-examine some decisions which they've made quite some time earlier on. We're supposed to have a design step, but we don't really have one. When people are developing the requirements for kernel features, they have a very good idea of how they're going to implement it, and they're not going to come up with a requirement which cannot be implemented in the context of what's acceptable in the kernel anyway. So we tend to perform design and requirements analysis both at the same time. And it's important to understand that many kernel features are very small. It'd be rare for a kernel feature to be more than a person a year. The kernel is a collection of probably 10,000 different person-week projects with just a small number of larger ones. The actual development of the feature will happen at the contributing group's site. They will hopefully follow the kernel coding guidelines so they don't get wrapped on the knuckles when they come out with it. And they will perform the initial testing, stress testing, and code review. And then they will submit the code for review. The code submission should be broken up into a reasonably small piece. Each piece should be of the order of a person day to maybe a person month's work. Not a million lines of code, please. Their submission will be reviewed, it must be reviewed, and frequently a rework of their submission will be requested. Once we've reached an acceptable stage with respect to reviewing, it doesn't have to be perfect, as long as we understand that we're pretty close for getting through the review process, their submission will be merged into a subsystem tree if it's applicable to one of the subsystem trees. If it's not, I'll stick it in my tree. It's at this stage that things really, really go bad if it was developed in isolation, if it's cathedral-style code from SourceForge. The submission is just so large that nobody has the time or energy or will to review the code for them, and that's pretty much a showstopper. The other thing, I think, which makes people reluctant to review a large submission is that once you've reviewed it and said, yeah, it looks okay to me, you're kind of responsible if it goes wrong. And I don't think people want to take that risk because they'll end up blaming themselves for getting a bad feature into the kernel. And there can be some of these large submissions, the review results are so disappointing that the contributors, they just disappear. They never come back. They either abandon the feature or they decide to carry it as an external patch forever. And everybody loses when that happens. The code review process, we do it all. I work via email. The code review happens on the mailing list, the relevant mailing list. I do feel that the Git merging process which we use, where code goes in the subsystem tree and then into Linux's tree, I think this weakens our review process because simply the number of people who get to look at a patch is less than if it was submitted via email to Linux with a CC to the mailing list. So what I've frequently done is ask subsystem maintainers, yep, fine, okay, you're setting up a Git tree, you're merging your patches in with Linux, but please still try to find some way to get your patches on the relevant mailing list so we can get more people looking at them. And we'll occasionally pick up a defect and have a question and request an enhancement. And people are good about that, so it puts a lot of stress on the kernel mailing list and Dave Miller starts complaining, but I think it's best. And you'll notice that the PCI tree, the USB tree, the DVB tree, and many other trees do get individual patches sent to the mailing list purely for people to review. Code review takes a long time, and it takes a non-linear amount of time. Probably goes up with a square of the size of the patch. And it really does require that the person who does the code review is an expert in the area which the code is touching. A SCSI developer might feel happy reviewing a network driver, but he's not going to pick up a lot of stuff. It really does require a network driver maintainer or developer to review a network driver patch. And often these people aren't available. It takes a lot of time to do a review, and this can be a rate-limiting step for us. It's not aided by the fact that people don't prepare very well for the reviewing step. People think, oh, my code's ready, I've spent months and months working on it. Sling it off the mailing list with some stupid little comment on top. Doesn't help anybody when they do that. People don't spend enough time describing what their work does, how it does it, why they did this work. And often the code is inadequately commented. Commenting is invaluable at the review stage. People tend to just think it's useful when the code's in the tree and other people are trying to maintain it. No, it's even more important at the review step. And I'll frequently bounce patches for them. Reject patches due to inadequate commenting. The next step, once we pass the review process, is the code will be merged. It's moved into Linux's tree. This takes about 30 seconds. Linux just has to type some command, so it's not really a step at all. Once the code is in Linux's tree, we'll expect there'll be bugs, there'll be problems as more people test it and more people review it. And that's fine. We expect these things to happen. And we will work pretty hard with the development team to get their patches, get people to test their feature, to get their patches merged up promptly so they have the best possible code in the first major release where their feature's available to the public. Testing of your new feature. Initially, hopefully, the person who wrote the code tested it a bit. It'll go in the subsystem tree, and some people do test the subsystem trees, and I will merge the subsystem trees into the MM kernel. Consequently, the new feature will have been in the subsystem tree and or the MM kernel for a couple of months before it hits Linux's tree. Once it's in Linus's tree, it'll be under public test probably for another couple of months before we actually, while we're going through the release candidate phase. So by the time this feature actually pops up in Linus's tree, it's been under public test for maybe 3 months. Most of the testing is done by those crazy people who download a kernel.org kernel and run it on their machines. We are totally dependent on the testing community. I don't know how many people there are, maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000. There are people who will download the latest kernel, test the thing, and report bugs back to us. We're totally dependent on these people. The reason they're such a strength is because there are so many of them, because they respond so quickly. We'll get a bug report within hours of a bug hitting Linus's tree. They have direct access to our developers. They'll directly engage into a dialogue with the guy who wrote the bug and get the thing fixed up. So it's all very quick and immediate. And, of course, the 1,000 people, the 10,000 people, they have 1,000 or 10,000 machines. And they also throw workloads onto these machines which nobody else thought to do. So that sheer amount of coverage testing which we can get by getting 1,000 different people to run 1,000 different workloads on 1,000 different machines is much more than the individual developer could possibly have done. It's very wasteful of resources to perform QA in this manner, but it's very effective for us. We've got the resources, so we use them. But I don't think we use them as well as we can. Many, many times, a wonderful person, will download the latest kernel, they'll find some bug and they'll report it, and not only does it not get fixed, sometimes nobody even responds to their email. This makes me angry, and I send grumpy emails to people when it happens. Now, it is a hassle because many of these bugs, the developer can't reproduce it. Really, nobody can reproduce it. The only person who can reproduce it is the guy who reported the bug. The only way we can resolve the defect is for the developer to enter into this long, painful email conversation with the reporter, getting him to do different things, try debug patches, try test patches, do a bisection search to find out when the problem was introduced. It's painful, and understandably, developers are a bit reluctant to do that work. But there is no other way of doing it. Also, sometimes somebody's kernel stopped working, and it's not really clear who we should blame. If your sound card stopped working, it could be the ACPI went wrong, or the IRQ routing went wrong, or the PCI bus scanning went wrong, or the memory management went wrong, or the device driver went wrong. And so if nobody's really clear who caused the bug, everybody kind of sits back and hopes somebody else will fix it. This is something else that gets you a grumpy email from Andrew. The great majority of the bugs in the kernel are in device drivers and in platform management code, you know, the stuff that talks to the onboard chips and sets up the DMA controllers and all that sort of thing. A number of reasons for that. First up, most of the kernel is device drivers and platform code, so that's where most of the bugs are going to occur. But also this code is much harder to develop because in device drivers you're dealing with bugs in the hardware, you're dealing with bugs in the BIOS, you're dealing with 10, 20, 34 different 30 different generations of the hardware running on thousands of different types of machines. It's poorly documented. Sometimes the hardware is not documented at all. And the guy who wrote the code doesn't have access to even 1% of the hardware which it's supposed to run on. And the kernel is unique in this manner. I mean, there is no other software project on which developers can't test their code. So it's a problem for us. The core kernel, if you like, the device-independent part of the kernel, I think has a much lower defect rate than the device drivers, simply because everybody tests it, so it gets more coverage testing, and also the people who work on that code are able to test their own code to completion, because they're not dependent on having particular hardware. The stable tree. This is something we started doing about a year ago, was release, if you like, an errata series against 2.6.x. Those changing 10,000 lines of code a day tends to break things, and we do have an ongoing problem with defects in the 2.6 tree. Now, if you like, the 2.6 kernel isn't really a product. I think in some ways it's more accurate to view it as a technology component which goes into distributions. The distributions go through a QA and beta process and turn our technology into a product. But then again, people do want to use 2.6 kernels. We can't use that as an excuse. People do want to use kernel.org kernels in production. In particular, our testers want to use it. And we want to keep it good quality for our testers. And we were getting some complaints. We were aware that 2.6 releases were a little bit buggy. So we decided about a year ago to run the stable tree. So once we've released 2.6.16, we will come out with 2.6.16.1.2.3, and I think we're up to about .14 now, which is simply, it's a branch, just like the old 2.4 and 2.2 and 2.0 were. It's a branch which contains bug fixes against the most recent released stable kernel. And I think that process is going pretty well. We're certainly putting a lot of fixes into the stable tree. But we don't have a very good process at present for identifying which fixes should be backported into the stable tree. I try to remember every time I see a patch, I think, maybe we should apply that to the stable tree, so I'll make sure that Greg and Chris and et cetera get to see it. But then I don't know if all the other maintainers are aware of that. It could be somebody fixes a bug in a network driver and they just don't think to send it into the stable tree and that bug doesn't get fixed. So I suspect quite a few fixes are slipping through the cracks. I do know that the distros also have engineers who watch what's going on the public list, on the public kernel. I mean, Red Hat, for example, are shipping still a 2.6.9 based kernel, and they've got people who watch everything that's going on the public kernel saying, gee, maybe we should backport that fix into our 2.6.9 based tree. So I'm thinking perhaps we could ask those people to say, well, you know, please also just tap us on the shoulder and remind us that we should backport that fix into the stable tree. I believe the 2.6 kernel is slowly getting buggier. I think we're adding bugs at a higher rate than we're fixing them. I can't prove that. I haven't done the analysis on the numbers. But I just see a lot of bug reports go past where somebody say, look, it worked in 2.6.16. It doesn't work in 2.6.15. Then I'll come back to that person after a month and say, is it fixed yet? And he'll say, nope. I don't have any statistics on that. It's hard to gather them because many of our bug reports really aren't bug reports at all. It's some glitch. The card wasn't plugged in correctly. Their machine dropped some memory. Their power supply went, the refrigerator turned on. All sorts of nasty things happen in kernel world. So some bug reports are just so weird you have to just ignore them and pretend that they didn't happen. This makes analysis hard. You need to work out which the bugs really are real bugs and which are just glitches. But I do believe that many of our post 2.6.0 regressions have not been fixed. So we're leaving an increasing number of machines behind us which just don't work anymore. But I can't prove that yet. One of the problems we have is if these bugs pop up, developers frequently don't do enough work to resolve them. Developer can't reproduce the bug. That's always the case. We can't reproduce the bug if it affects hardware. Frequently, a bug will affect a very old computer or an old peripheral, one that nobody's selling anymore, one that nobody has a business interest in. So if you're a company who employs a Linux kernel maintainer, you really don't have a business interest in having your maintainer work on some five-year-old peripheral, which nobody's selling anymore. That's just the real world. I can understand that. But it's a problem for us because people are still using that hardware. On the other hand, even though these companies maybe have no commercial interest in a very old peripheral card, they need to understand that the presence of that bug does affect the whole kernel process because it takes time from me. We may elect to hold up a release because we've got these bugs which still need fixing and nobody's working on them. So there is a global effect from failing to resolve bugs. Also, I think the distributors probably have more interest in getting bugs against old hardware fixed up because they want to maintain goodwill with the people who use their kernel. And some of those people do use old hardware. So a little action item I've given myself is to actually do the numerical analysis and confirm that this trend, this increasing defect rate in the kernel really is happening. And then I think, as I suspect it is, we will need to do something about it. That something will have to be a process change, and it doesn't matter what it is, the end result of that process change will have to be that kernel developers are going to have to reapportion some of their time. Whatever they are doing, they need to take some of that time, spend more of their time fixing bugs. One possible idea I've got here, and I haven't floated it with any other guys yet, is perhaps once a year we might have an entire kernel cycle in which we put no cleanups, no features, no nothing. It's purely for fixing up long-standing bugs. I might get shot down over that, I don't know, but part of that depends on the analysis, which I haven't performed yet. That's it. So we have about 30 minutes left. One thing is, I am here to serve you people. It's my job to make you people happy. So it'd probably be in a better use of our time not to have me standing here telling you stuff. It's probably better for you to tell me stuff. Because if I don't know how well I'm serving you people, I'll continue to serve you incorrectly. So yep, I will welcome questions, but I would also welcome statements. If you want to tell me something, tell me we suck, tell me we're doing something wrong. That's important information. So. What is the state of Riser for? Caffeine and alcohol. Okay. Give you the long story. Hans is a bit of a visionary. He has these ideas about what a file system can and should do. And so he has ideas about interfaces, new interfaces, which a file system should offer to applications, which go considerably beyond what POSIX does. And he implemented those within Riser 4 in cathedral mode and then hit us with it. And there was a lot of resistance to this because we hadn't agreed that these are the sorts of things that we want Linux to offer to applications, these extensions to the namespace, to the concept of a directory, the concept of a file. And if we had made the decision that these are features we wanted Linux to offer, we wouldn't have implemented them within a file system. We would have implemented within the virtual file system, and then so most of the infrastructure was happening at a generic layer. So the way Riser 4, it offered features that we weren't sure we wanted, and it implemented them in a non-Linux sort of way. Okay, so we had a little flame war about that for a few months. And Hans went in and took all those features out. So the Riser 4, which has been in my tree for about 2 years now, it's just a vanilla Linux file system. It doesn't really extend the file system interface at all. And it's kind of stuck because nobody has signed up to review it. I told Hans about 5-6 months ago that, I'd do the review myself, and I was not able to find the time to do so. And so really it's stuck now, simply from the lack of, as far as I'm concerned, from the lack of reviewing resources. There are really very few people who I think could adequately review Riser 4, and those very few people, they got other stuff to do. So that's an unhappy situation. It's a system failure. If we had adequate reviewing resources, I think Riser 4 would be in now. I don't have a solution to that problem. I don't employ anyone. I can't direct anybody to do this work. It would help if some of the distros were shipping Riser 4, if they had engineers who understood it and were working on it. But right now, I don't think any of them do. So, simply a lack of resources. I'm going to attempt to see if we can do something about it, but I'm just going to have to ask people, what the hell do we do? Because I don't know. They have, but a lot of them are a lot more simple, and they've undergone considerably more review. Riser 4 does all sorts of strange things. It goes fiddling around in the VM code, it fiddles in the read ahead code, the write back code, cuts in at a very high level and does its own thing. And some skilled person needs to review that and look at the code, which is, we need to understand why it's doing things, why it finds the core kernel facilities inadequate, why it was necessary to change them. It's a lot of work. It's big and it's complex. Whereas, yes, we've merged other file systems, but generally they just use the existing interfaces and did things, and we are able to review them. So it's not a personal thing, it's not a political thing, it's simply lack of resources, I'm afraid.
So. Yeah, since you asked for a statement, I've always wondered about the big overlap between X and the kernel, like both handle a keyboard, both handle a mouse, this kind of stuff, and I've always wondered why graphics drivers are in X and not in the kernel.
Don't know. I don't work on that stuff. Yeah, it is a disaster, and I know that it's something that causes David Ehrlich no amount of grief, and there is, particularly at the PCI level, the interaction between the management of the PCI cards. X does all sorts of weird things. I guess one of the reasons is, at least in the XF86 days, they wanted X to be able to run on multiple operating systems. So instead of going to have to maintain the BSD drivers and the Linux drivers and the Solaris drivers, etc., by moving them all in the user space, they could use one set. But it's not an area I work in, so I really couldn't give an intelligent answer on that. So.
Have you considered using any automated source code review tools, either as part of your own interest in analysing bug frequency, or as part of the actual review procedure itself?
I didn't know there were such things. People regularly run Coverity on the code, but that's to identify defects and locking errors and uninitialized variables and use after free and things like that. But I wasn't aware that there were such things as code review case tools. No.
Well, no, that's the sort of tool I make.
Hmm. No.
Recently, there's been a discussion on the Linux kernel mailing list about the future of the LSM infrastructure. Can you elaborate on that? Some people try to convince you or Linus to throw it out again because the modules themselves were not as good as, let's say, as a Linux perhaps.
Have you seen how long it's taken for us to remove DevFS from the kernel? Do you know it's still there? 2 years ago, DevFS was supposed to be removed. We are pretty reluctant to remove stuff. So we do remove things sometimes, but because there are people out there doing development against LSM and using LSM for code which they hope to get merged up, my expectation is that it's going to be very hard to get it out of there. As long as somebody's using it for decent-looking code and developing useful features against it and getting those features merged up, I could be wrong, but I doubt if we're going to remove it. I haven't been paying a lot of attention to that discussion yet, and the security stuff makes my brain spin. And there are good people working on it, but I do understand those people do have competing interests as well. So I don't think it'll be gone very soon. Yes, sir.
At the moment, every distro vendor seems to create their own sanitized kernel headers for linking against the GNU C library and for user space applications. Yeah. Can you comment on the future of this and on the current state?
Well, that's something that David Woodhouse at Red Hat's been working on lately. We've been talking about it on and off for several years, that the generation of headers for user space is something we don't handle very well. There's potential because basically it's a clone and own operation. That user space ends up with headers which are incorrect. There's no really easy answer to that one, but it's something that David Woodhouse is working on, and I'll merge his code into my tree next week when I get back. His approach is you run some special little command on the within the kernel build system, which will actually generate all the headers for you. So it'll actually go through and strip out the stuff which isn't supposed to be there, and I think it generates a separate set of headers. So it's an automated process by which we will generate those headers. How much work will be involved in integrating those headers into glibc and all those wonderful command line defines you use to enable various interfaces, I do not know. But I know Linus has pretty strong opinions on that, that there's just no way people should take the existing kernel headers and use them in user space. He likes people to actually take a copy of them. And if that's done in an automated fashion that's acceptable to Linus, I'd imagine that's the way we're going to go.
Could you please give some pointers on how somebody can start contributing code, or where can he start from if I want to contribute a code to the kernel?
You mean you already have code, or you want to become a kernel developer?
I just want to start on the board.
You just want to start doing kernel stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The way I started... Look where I am today. The way I started was fixing bugs. The only thing. Just sit there on the kernel mailing list, and I maintained a couple of network drivers, but I spent probably 1.5 years doing nothing but working, fixing bugs in the 2.3 kernel. Didn't matter what it was. Could be anywhere, in any subsystem. If nobody was responding to the reporter, I just worked with them. Get in there, try and understand the subsystem, try and fix their bug for them. And it's a wonderful way to learn the code base. You can sit there and read a file for hour and hour and hour and not understand it. But all of a sudden, if you need to make a change to that, if you actually need to fix something or put in some debugging work, your understanding of the code you're working on expands enormously. So my recommendation, yeah, don't attempt to take over a subsystem or write some new feature. Just try and work on bugs. It's a really good way to gain understanding of many kernel mechanisms and how the kernel hangs together and works. If that's not to your taste, there are no end of device drivers which really don't have a maintainer anymore. We're always free to adopt a driver, clean the thing up, find the hardware first, clean the thing up, stress test it, or fix it, break it. There are a number of SCSI drivers which are still using the wrong API. I mean, the kernel's not a particularly exciting place to work. It's a great bunch of legacy code base that controls legacy hardware or implementing a legacy POSIX API and used by a bunch of legacy users. It's not particularly glamorous. It's just a lot of maintenance.
You mentioned... the code review,
yes,
in the process, and you pointed out that there are a lot of problems concerning bugs and that the kernel may be getting buggier in the future. Did you consider to strengthen the design step, the design phase, and to include design review in front before problems occur in the implementation so that you can identify problems before they really occur in the implementation?
Okay. Most of our bugs, I'm particularly concerned about regressions, where somebody's taken some code which was presently working, they've done something to it, maybe to fix some particular platform, and they've broken something else. Now, in that case, there really was no design associated with that work. I mean, it's not a feature, if you like. It may be 10, 20, 30 lines, they've changed the PCI scanning order, or they've set this bit in that register. So really that is purely an implementation, a review of implementation, a testing issue. And I think the only solution we have that problem is when problems are reported, we be more responsive in fixing them up. So what you're talking about really is new features, where something which is sufficiently large to actually have some design behind it. I just spent an hour saying we should be more careful about socializing our design, getting that design identified, all the particular stakeholders identified, and looking at that design. Maybe I'm being thick, but I don't quite see how additional review at that design stage will reduce the number of defects in the implementation. But that's not the area I'm concerned about. I'm more concerned about defects in existing code rather than new code. Actual regressions, breakage.
I've done a bunch of things with the various embedded Linux groups, And in doing so, we run across a variety of interesting pieces of code that may work on the x86 base, but don't work when we port them to our non-standard platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Is the general Linux... I'll check later and see if they're in the current 2.6.16, and I'll still find them there. I'm wondering whether there's any interest in fixing the anomalies that must affect Sparks or something. I don't run across them on my x86, but I certainly run across them on ARMs and things.
I kind of missed that. I'm sorry. I mean, you said you found some particular defects in the code base that affect what platforms?
If you port some of the Linux kernel, especially the drivers and file systems.
The kernel itself?
There are parts of the kernel that will break when they don't have, say, no alignment restrictions in particular.
You're porting it to a new microprocessor?
Well, I will port it to a microprocessor, and I find various parts that break, and then I'll go check and see how it's written in the current, because we tend to do the cathedral code on micros. We don't tend to re-merge very often. But we find these errors that aren't strictly errors, because if you compile them with GCC for 686, they'll be fine. But if you compile them for an alternate platform, like an ARM9 or for a 68K, they immediately cause a problem.
But
you try to submit them back, and your bug report looks kind of odd because it's not from an x86. Is there any interest in getting bug patches from the non-PC world?
Certainly. I mean, if any device driver, unless it's under Arch i386, is supposed to work on every CPU we support. So if you found a particular device driver which does the wrong thing on a non-86 architecture, that's a bug. Send a patch. Copy me on it. So if the maintainer drops it, I will pick it up and I will make his life hell until we fixed it. Send a patch. Stop asking silly questions. Honestly.
Is it supposed to be slow? Or?
Yes, it is. It is.
But that's, in that way, it's terribly slow.
That's the VFAT on USB stick problem. Every file system in Linux is supposed to support the sync option, where all writes will happen synchronously. So before you return from system call, it is on permanent storage. VFAT didn't support that. It was buggy. So we fixed it. Problem was, lots of distributions were happily mounting their USB sticks with the sync option. With the sync option. And of course, once VFAT correctly started implementing that, it did stink, really slow. It was a fix, but it was a non-backward compatible fix. It's not a correctness problem. I'm sorry, there's nothing, well, there is something. The best thing you could do is take out the sync option from your mount scripts. That will give you exactly the same behavior you used to have before we fixed the kernel. But we do understand that it is a bit of a problem. So Ogawa, Japanese gentleman who maintains FAT, he has been working on some code which will do something smarter. So rather than every single write system call doing a sync and synchronously writing to the device, what we thought we can do is we'll only do a sync on close. So you can open a file, do write, it's all buffered up in memory, then when you close the file, we'll sync it then. So it's a sort of a weak sync. That will give you the semantics which you want. Well, it should perform much better than the existing code. But that patch, seemed to have got lost. He hasn't quite finished that yet. So, sorry, I'm just going to take out the stink option.
No more questions?
No.
Andrew, how far do you think we got with the... XFS adoption and the Linux kernel in terms of, fixing areas like kernel stack footprints, overflows, and so on and so forth?
As far as I know, the stack wind-up problems in XFS have been addressed. The XFS team seem fairly happy that they're not using too much stack. I'm still not completely comfortable with 4K stacks. I know if I cared, I'd use 8K stacks on my machines, because 8K ain't much. The only remaining problem which I'm aware of is I believe we can use arbitrary amounts of stack with, I think, device mapper. If you just do map on map on map on map on map, we do end up doing recursive calls, and we can get stack wind up in that manner. I've had a scary patch in my tree probably for a year or so now from Neil Brown, which takes away that recursion and turns it into a sort of flat iteration, which the patch seems to just scare the device mapper developers. So it's still not merged into mainline. I'm not aware of any problems with it. So that's the only area I'm aware of where there's difficulties. It's a theoretical possibility you could get stack wind up in that area. As far as I understand, the distro ship with 4K stacks. They have had a couple of glitches here and there. But I don't know. If it's a critical server and you want to sleep at night, I'd go for 8K stacks personally.
Yeah, my question departs a little bit from the engineering questions and goes a little bit more to marketing. Every software company knows revision numbers are a marketing issue, not an engineering issue.
Mm-hmm.
When will we have another major revision number?
No plans. We have no intention at present of going up to 2.67, to 2.7 or to 2.8 or anything else. We only change the kernel development process in response to perceived problems. You know, we're forever making little tunings to it. We identify here's a particular problem, we'll make this change, process change to attempt to address it. I think it would take some sort of complete catastrophe right now to happen in the kernel world to force us to open 2.7. And I hope catastrophes do not happen in the kernel world. If we were to branch off 2.6.20 and then open 2.7.0, I don't know how we could do that, really, because I don't think the distros would be in a position where they could use 2.6.20 for any period of time, because all the features would be going to 2.7 and people want those features. So I think we're kind of committed to the new development process. If there are problems with it, I think we need to address those problems independently rather than going back to the old model. If you want us to rename it to 3.0, we can, but nothing really fundamentally would have changed. Well, I think we should rename it to AKPMX.
What's the state of virtualization features being merged into the kernel, in particular the Xen merge and also the other virtualization approaches like vServer and OpenVZ?
Xen, vServer, and things like that. Xen has been a problem for reasons which I've talked about at length here. I've been a bit of a sticking point for Xen as well, because I'm a bit concerned that we've never really sat and decided how we want to perform virtualization on Linux. In particular, do we want or para-virtualization of Linux. In particular, do we want to change the kernel so it has a Xen-only interface, or would it be a better approach to come up with some sort of hypervisor-agnostic interface, one which is almost like the system call interface, we say. This is how Linux interfaces to the hypervisor. Doesn't have to be a Xen-specific hypervisor, maybe it's just... It's a major interface which we maintain in a hypervisor-neutral fashion. That may be a stupid thing to say. I don't know. I'm not a hypervisor developer. But I would like to at least have that question asked and answered. Right now, there are various forces, various pressures trying to get us to merge Xen as is into the tree, and I'm not happy with that right now, because I don't think we've answered the question of that's how we want to do hypervirtualization on Linux for the next 10 or 20 years. Maybe it is. But I just want people to be able to demonstrate that. So we haven't, as far as I'm concerned, we haven't gone through that process yet. So this is all coming to a head, and I expect it'll be a topic of... It was a topic of a lot of discussion at Kernel Summit last year. I expect it'll be a lot more discussion again this year. I would expect Zen to be in the public kernel, certainly by 12 months from now, in one shape, some shape or another. But I expect it to be there last July, and it didn't happen. The Zen team have seemed to be some way reluctant to work with the public kernel people. They've done a lot of work with the distros. The distros are shipping the feature to end users, but we've seen some stuff from them, but they haven't really fully engaged their kernel development team. And it's got to happen sometime. We've got to go through those patches line by line, weed through the uglies, work out what's going on. We just need to go through the process. And the later we start, the later it'll happen. With respect to other virtualization technologies, yeah, I sat through the talk the other day looking at Virtuoso, was it? The vServer stuff. And that's virtualizing the operating system rather than virtualizing the hardware seems a very good idea to me. If that satisfies users' requirements, why have multiple copies of the Linux kernel sitting around in memory when all you really want is multiple copies of the Linux kernel interface? Seems good to me, but I'm not a virtualization person, and I don't want to become a virtualization person. What I want is all those various groups to identify the other stakeholders, and we all know who they are, and come up with some sort of consensus design which they're all happy with. That's in an ideal world. Now, these people have gone so far down the path with their products shipping it to customers that they're unlikely ever to find common ground. This puts people like myself and Linus in the very unfortunate position of having to pick and choose, pick a winner. And that's something we don't want to have to do. We don't want to have to become experts in device mapper or virtualization or iSCSI. We don't want to be put in the position where we have to make a call. We would rather the affected parties make that decision amongst themselves and come up with some sort of consensus position. So, yeah, we are heading towards a sort of systemic failure on the hyper-virtualization front. But yeah, me and my own naive, stupid little, I don't know, hyper-virtualization mode, I think virtualizing the OS looks like a good way to go, although the patches look pretty horrible. But it's not a happy story. Any more hands?
Andrew, when you pick a patch from the mailing list after some discussion,
yes,
and it gets merged into your MM tree, all stakeholders receive a mail notification saying your patch has been merged to MM tree. And from there on, all the way when you submit things to different upstream Git trees or when you do remove it from the MM tree again because either it's not worth keeping or because it has been accepted upstream,
yeah,
people get a mail notification, which is very good because it's very transparent from the contributor's perspective.
Mm.
My question is, how is the contributor supposed to figure for what reason you picked the patch to put it into the MM tree? Because sometimes you do pick patches for testing purposes so that many people can test it, and sometimes you do pick patches in order to line it up for the next development cycle.
Yes, it can be hard, and people occasionally do ask me, you know, what are you doing with this patch? Generally speaking, people should know what's going to happen to their patch simply by knowing where we are in the development process. If your patch doesn't fix a bug, it's going to go in the next release, you know, unless it's blatantly obvious what it does, or if it's just a cleanup that doesn't affect code generation or something like that, I'll sneak them in later on in the RC cycle. So the person who's submitting code should have a good expectation when it's going to be merged. Sometimes I don't know. I'll look at a patch and I realize it fixes a problem, but they just don't tell me how important that problem is. So sometimes I have to come back to the person and say, look, does this need to get in the next release? Is it an emergency fix or is it something we can defer later? So generally the person who's originating the patch should know what its priority is and hence what I'll be doing with it. I'll basically never discard somebody's patch without telling them why beforehand. If I'm going to drop a patch, I don't want somebody to see that patch is removed and say, well, why'd they do that? So I generally email them first and say, look, for this and this reason, I'm going to toss your patch away. And then, so given that, I'll always tell people before I drop a patch, they know that when I remove a patch from my tree, that it's gone somewhere else. It's either gone into Greg's tree or one of the Git trees, or Linus has taken it. And they know when Linus took it because they also CC'd when I, or whoever, they also CC'd when I sent it to somebody else. So as long as they're awake and as long as they're reading their email, they know what happened to it. But yeah, it gets complex sometimes, but people just ask me and I tell them.
I compile my kernels myself, and last time I switched to the latest version, IP tables broke completely. My question or comment is there any kind of high-level changelog? Because I really don't want to read a 1,000-page changelog to find out that IP tables has completely changed. So is there a really high-level, let's say, 2 pages, 3 pages changelog for kernel releases?
Not really. We just have a massive changelog.
I'm sorry.
It's just a group of individual changes. So, no, I think the information you're looking for there is not really available. Then again, if you have some sort of idea of what piece of the kernel changed, for example, if you're using a particular IP tables for connection tracking for SIP, say, something like that broke, if you can identify the source file, you can go in through the Git web interface, and then you can look at the changes that were made to that file, and then you can go back. So you can see all the change sets which affected that particular file. So probably one way to get the information you want is to go into the particular source files in the Git tree and go back and see who did what to them.
Okay, and since you were requesting comments, would be a good idea for perhaps to write such a 2 or 3 page change log with every main release?
Well, we could. There is a website. I've got it bookmarked, but I forget where it is, where some kind person maintains a list of all the features that have gone into each major release, and it's quite detailed. But again, I don't think that will actually give you information about who did what and why and when. It doesn't have links to the change sets and things. So that's a good high-level perspective of what's gone into 2.6.15. But again, I don't think that would be adequate for your purposes, identifying a particular regression. The other point is, you shouldn't have to do that work. If your IP tables is busted, you need to get an email out to NetDev list, and it's Patrick McHardy's job to work out which change set broke it, not yours.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about a specific bug. It's a kind of architecture change when some kind of a core moved to different kernel configuration parameters, so IP tables was no longer compiled.
Okay. Oh, so it's
just if I make a make old config and just let it go, then IP tables is no longer compiled as a module as before. It's not a bug. You need to change your config and set different parameters, and then it works again. But
No, I don't think there's any place you could have gone to found that apart from Googling for the error messages is my normal way, and I don't really know anybody who's likely to want to do that work, I'm afraid. Most efficient way is to rip an email out to the mailing list and get somebody else to tell you what went wrong.
Well, I can see there are still a few more questions, but we're just about out of time now. Andrew, you'll be around later this afternoon
for the questioning. We have a 1 hour session between 5 and 6 here for general open kernel related issues.
Yeah, so if you come back at 5 o'clock, then there'll be another chance to ask Andrew and some of the rest of us other questions. The next talk in here now is on iSCSI by Matthias Reckenberg. And so I'd like to thank Andrew ever so much for travelling over here.